The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart.
The following candidates are now eligible to continue on to the next ballot.
We're approaching the final stages of the Tory beauty contest. By the end of today, we'll know whether it's Javid, Hunt or Gove who's made it to the final two, most likely in order to be soundly beaten by Boris Johnson next month. But if, as we expect, it's a coronation for Johnson, what next? Can he really take us out of the EU by October the 31st? And also this week, we talked to Labour MPs Clive Lewis about Labour's latest Brexit shilly-shallying and Stella Creasy about maternity rights for MPs. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, despite making contradictory promises to opposing wings of the Tory party, hiding from press and public scrutiny, and a lacklustre showing on the TV candidates' debate, Johnson is still the man to beat in the race to become our next Prime Minister. Can anything make a dent in his popularity with party members at this stage? And if he is elected, how on earth will he fulfil his promise to take Britain out of the EU by the end of October? Well, I'm joined to discuss all that by The Guardian's Anoushka Astana, Ryan Shorthouse from Bright Blue, and Anand Menon from UK in a Changing Europe. So, Anoushka, it seems like there's an awful lot of shenanigans been going on in Westminster, a bit of tactical voting, a bit of poor old Rory Stewart got knocked out yesterday. As a result, some people said, as of a sort of deliberate attempt to get him out of the race.
I mean, it was weird, wasn't it? He went from a weird 37 backers, which we weren't expecting, down to 27, which suggests some funny business happened, maybe the day before, maybe to try and knock out Dominic Raab. I mean, Andrea Jenkins yesterday was saying that she had been to a Boris Johnson meeting after Dominic Raab got knocked out, who she was backing, and there was no talk of such tactical voting. But I suspect he just does it with his favourite ones. And
you probably wouldn't tell a Dominic Raab supporter, would you, that you'd try to knock him out of the race?
I don't want to make guesses because loads of people will obviously be listening to this after we know, but I can just imagine them running around whispering into ears to back Jeremy Hunt today.
Do you think that's right, Ryan? Rory Stewart did sort of pep up the race for a bit, didn't he, until he got knocked out?
Yeah, I mean, some people are saying the debate, the leaders' debate on the BBC, where he didn't perform as well as he has been doing as well, perhaps came across a bit sort of weird, that put off some MPs. But, you know, I'm sure it's a mixture of that and some tactical voting.
And he was rather different to the other candidates, it seemed. His claim was that he would be the best person to take on Johnson because he can ask him difficult questions. I mean, is there any way of pinning Johnson down, of derailing him at this stage, do you think?
Well, I think it's Boris's to lose. And I think the person who can knock out Boris is Boris himself by doing something or saying something rather stupid. But, you know, in terms of the MP support and the wider voluntary party, it looks very likely that it's going to be Johnson as the next Prime Minister. And why is it that Boris is kind of hoovering up support from different wings of the party, unlikely people like Robert Buckland, Damien Green, Matt Hancock, Bim Afolami, all coming in behind Boris? You know, all of them have very different interpretations of what we should do on Brexit compared to some of the ERGers who have also fallen behind Boris. My feeling is that they are picking somebody to really deal with the task in hand. And that is not extensive renegotiation with the EU. It's an election. And I think we're going to have an election earlier than what a lot of people think, because this current parliament has proven time and time again that it cannot break the Brexit impasse. The Prime Minister's deal tried several times, and we even had indicative votes on alternative compromise Brexit situations.
Yeah, to try and find that majority that was sitting there somewhere in Parliament.
And there ain't a majority anywhere.
This is such a kind interpretation of why Matt Hancock is backing Boris Johnson. The reason Matt Hancock is backing Boris Johnson is because Boris Johnson's going to win and he wants to have a job in his government.
Yes, but I'm
very
also
cynical, Anoushka.
No, I think, you know, there's probably part of that, but why a lot of MPs are coming behind Boris is because they feel that he can win an election compared to other candidates, that he can take support from the Brexit Party voters. And also, as, for example, when he was mayor, he managed to get people in a very liberal city, London, people who might otherwise vote for Labour or Liberal Democrats, to come to the Tories. So they feel the task in hand is an election, not extensive renegotiations with the EU. And the best person placed to win an election for the Tories is Boris.
And Arne, you were nodding vigorously when Ryan said he thought an election would come sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I think an election has to come for the reasons Ryan said. If you have votes to spare, you would be stupid not to use them to make sure that you're facing the person you want to face in the final runoff. And actually, because Boris Johnson wants to be the eccentric insurgent, the last thing he wants to face is an eccentric insurgent. So getting rid of Rory Stewart makes eminent sense.
An eccentric Etonian insurgent, yeah. We should say.
But also, I think it's going to be fantastic when he becomes Prime Minister, because he's going to have 10 chancellors. You'll never have seen a government like it because, you know, from all the rumours doing the rounds, he's promised the same job to so many different people. It's just going to be brilliant to watch.
And what about the Brexit promises? I mean, in the television debate, he was quite hard to pin down. You know, he said leaving by the 31st of October was eminently feasible, which is rather different to what he seems to have told sort of Marc Francois and the ERG, who say, well, Boris looked me in the eye and he told me we're definitely leaving. I mean, is the election the way that he has to resolve that in the end?
Yes, I think so, because I don't think anyone who's in the least bit familiar with what it means would want to take us into a no-deal situation, because I don't see how you win an election afterwards. I mean, we just out of interest, a couple of weeks ago, we dug up the polling from September 2000, when, as you'll remember, we had the refinery blockades. And 2 days before those refinery blockades, Labour were polling at about 49% and were about 20-odd percent ahead of the Tories. You know, you remember those days when the Tories were disappearing into the rearview mirror.
Simple times, yeah.
3 days after those refinery blockades, and we didn't run out of petrol, we just nearly ran out of petrol, remember, the Tories had their only lead in that parliament. And if you think that was a disruption, it would be as nothing compared to the things you will see on telly from No Deal, because we can't prepare for all eventualities. There's going to be disruption at ports, there's going to be tailbacks, there's going to be shortages of some stuff just because of the legal uncertainty. I don't see how you have an election and win after leading us into that.
All right, but what's your pitch then? What's Boris's pitch? If he's having an election to sort of get through the fact that he's made contradictory promises to MPs and the EU won't give him what he wants, what's his pitch?
Well, I mean, his pitch will be Parliament is a mess. I need a majority to secure Brexit. Give me that majority. But this is where it strikes me the Tories are making.
What? And then I renegotiate?
Well, he might be sort of completely Delphically unclear about what he's going to do. He's done that quite well.
He often
up to
is,
now.
Yeah.
But I think the Tories are making a big miscalculation here, because you hear a lot of Conservatives saying, you know, Boris is the Heineken politician. He won London. He won London against Ken Livingstone, who was the candidate of a Labour Party that was coming towards the end of its third term, that had just had the Iraq War. The notion that Boris Johnson is necessarily the person to win against the left strikes me as fanciful.
I mean, also, he's a completely different politician than he was when he won London, because he took that decision, and it was a massive decision for him to take a side on this incredibly divisive thing. And, you know, the polls that Ryan's talking about, that the MPs are looking at, are very hypothetical. They say, what would happen in a hypothetical election against Jeremy Corbyn? We know that Jeremy Corbyn tends to underscore in polls outside election periods. So, you know, we have to eventually learn from our mistakes from previous elections and not make predictions based on those. In terms of the underlying data for Boris Johnson, we say it time and again, and his team really hate it when we say it, but he is a Marmite politician. And if you break down those hypothetical polls and look at who he's popular with, yeah, he does well overall, but he does so badly among Remainers. And so what Labour will be thinking is that the advantage of Boris Johnson is that he will help mobilise the opposition against him. And in fact, I was talking to Tom Watson yesterday and I gave him the choice of all the leadership candidates and said, who are you most scared of? I included Rory Stewart in it, even though he had just been knocked out. And he said Rory Stewart. I mean, perhaps not surprising, because Rory Stewart appeals to Labour voters. But I said, well, not Boris Johnson. And he said, I think Boris Johnson is very beatable. Now, of course, he might say that because he knows he's going to win. But I did think there was some truth in this idea that they think they can mobilise opposition to him.
Yeah, Boris Johnson's probably the man to reunite the Labour Party in the way that Jeremy Corbyn has been this sort of solvent that's held the Tory party together, isn't he?
Yeah,
to some extent.
I mean, Anoushka is right. He's very much a Marmite candidate. But what evidence there is suggests that out of all the other Tory candidates, he's likely to be the one that can get the most majority support, even though it will be very divisive. If and when Boris becomes Prime Minister, I think he will call an election very shortly after doing so. And I don't think
Ryan will wait. Please don't tell me I'm going to have to cancel my summer holiday.
Well, I mean, I don't think he will wait till
Heather
a vote
a
of no
of
confidence. I mean, if we get to October the 31st, you know, it's very likely the EU will not budge. And Boris has said, if you believe it, that we're going to leave deal or no deal. And there are, I think, a significant number of Tory MPs who will vote, have a vote of no confidence, support a vote of no confidence in the government, in which case that will trigger an election.
And rather we will than accept no deal.
Yes. Yeah. And then we will go to a situation where Boris is fighting an election on the basis of standing for no deal. This is why I think he will go earlier on the front foot and essentially say, look, you know, give me one last chance, give me a mandate for one last chance with the EU before the October the 31st deadline. So he's not the no deal candidate, but he is saying it's definitely Brexit. Give me one final chance. And if not that, I will, you know, I will have the mandate for no deal. And the feeling is that may just be enough to make the EU blink at the final hour because he will have that mandate. Now, I'm not saying I necessarily think the EU will do that, but I think that's a lot of thinking behind some of the people who are in Boris's camp. And they feel that Boris can beat Jeremy Corbyn in an election. And also, if we had that in an election, I think it would be the showdown to break the Brexit impasse. It will finally be either Tories standing for Brexit, deal or no deal, or Labour will be pushed more strongly into a Remain direction, and we will have what in effect is like a second referendum of Conservatives standing
election,
for Brexit.
Yeah,
and then, you know, that will be incredibly divisive. I think it will show a failure of this Prime Minister and this Parliament to get a compromise deal through, but it will at least break the Brexit impasse, which cannot carry on as it is.
Anand, how on earth does all that look from the EU side, do you think?
Well, deeply irritating, I think, on one level, because, you know, Donald Tusk's parting remark at the last European Council was don't waste the time. On the other hand, I think they get the fact that actually we need what we now call an electoral event of some kind to break the logjam. They're prepared for that. I don't think there are any circumstances under which, if we look like we're having an election, they won't give us an extension if we need one. Whether they'll cave in or not, it's an interesting one because they really don't want no deal. But I don't see... It's interesting because Peter Foster, I don't know if we're allowed to mention rival publications. But
oh, no, just this once. Just this once.
He's been very, very interesting of late, tweeting about the fact that he thinks it is conceivable, if not likely, that the EU might, in extremis, give into a time-limited backstop if the only other option was no deal. Coming from Peter, that gives me pause for thought because I wouldn't have believed this.
Well, no deal is throwing Ireland under the bus.
Yeah.
And in the end, the EU has to try to support Ireland in that situation. Although I have another theory, which might not be true, but I have a theory that Boris Johnson will end up taking Theresa May's withdrawal agreement through Parliament. I think there's quite a shift among Labour MPs. I mean, when you read that letter from the 26 MPs who say they don't want a second referendum, the language they're saying is we now have to get this done and we have to get it done through the withdrawal agreement.
Yeah, although they were given three opportunities to vote
They've
for that withdrawal agreement.
I mean, my doubt is
they
you're less likely...
They were pushed over the cliff.
Maybe, but isn't the logic that you're less likely to lend support to a new Tory Prime Minister you know you'll be facing in an election? Wouldn't it have been easier to back a lame duck Tory Prime Minister who you wouldn't be facing in another election?
I mean, I just think he's not going to get a change to the withdrawal agreement, you don't think, unless the one change he could maybe get, and I am persuaded by this, is to make it a NI-only backstop. And you
Which
do
we
wonder,
were offered, effectively, weren't we?
Yeah.
And Theresa May
if
said, no, I
can't do
that. If he
gets a majority, that's what he'd do.
I do wonder if he's willing to do that. But as you say, he would need a majority. So all roads lead to Boris and all roads lead on to a general election.
Is there just Heather's a narrow path, says woman not wanting to give up a holiday for the next 6 months. Is there just a narrow path by which he rushes off to Brussels, he gets perhaps that time limit on the backstop, then he comes back and then that goes through Parliament, doesn't it?
I mean, if you want me to say, Heather, it'll all be sorted out
just
by the end of July.
Just make me feel better,
it'll be
yeah.
fine. Then I will.
But
I've
that's
got my
the
fingers
sort of,
crossed.
Yeah, that's what Theresa May tried and failed to do in January, right?
Think about the time constraints as well. I mean, you know, whoever's the new Prime Minister comes in towards the end of July. Parliament then goes off on recess. The EU, the French are not going to forsake another August on the beach for us. They're not going to negotiate in August again, I don't think.
And the language again today by Mark Rutte from Holland is that they're not going to do it.
It's quite strong, yeah.
If they did do it, you can see all the arguments for doing it. But if they did... Yeah. God, you wouldn't believe them again in a negotiation.
But we've got 2 weeks. We've got 2 weeks at the start of September. And then we break up for the party conferences. And I think 3 days after the SNP come back is the European Council. You've got 2 weeks. You're not going to do much in 2 weeks.
I agree. I don't think the EU are going to budge. Unless, you know, Boris wins a majority in an early election and says, look, we're going on October the 31st. Either you do something or we're going. And I think, you know, that's perhaps the only way that they would budge.
Right. Thanks. We will be returning to Labour's equally thorny Brexit conundrum later in the show.
It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups in violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anoushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome back. Earlier this year, proxy voting was finally introduced to Parliament after Labour MP Tulip Sadiq was forced to delay her caesarean section and vote in a wheelchair. Now Walthamstow MP Stella Creasy, who is pregnant, says that women are being forced to choose between being an MP and being a mum because of Parliament's rules. IPSA, the body which regulates MPs' pay, doesn't recognise any form of maternity leave or provide extra support for constituency work after an MP gives birth. Jessica Elgott met Stella at her Westminster office and began by asking what made her decide to go public with something as personal as this.
I had always tried to keep my personal and my professional life separate, but the decision of the parliamentary authorities basically to not engage at all with my request about cover for maternity leave meant I was in a position where I felt I was going to have to say to Walthamstow, the constituents I represent, that they wouldn't get the service that they've been getting for 6 months, or I was going to have to say that I wouldn't be able to spend time with a newborn child. And I felt that was a choice that nobody should have to make. I hear from people online and offline all the time about all the problems of electing women and having women in positions of responsibility. And I thought we've got to take one of the reasons people have for that, which is pregnancy, off the table. So I felt no option but to speak out. Doesn't mean it was easy. I was terrified as I knew the article was going to be published. I had found it very difficult to talk about what had happened to me with some of my best friends, let alone with the broader public. Since then, I've had hundreds of messages from both men and women, actually, who've experienced miscarriages and difficulties having children. And I think there is a wider conversation about how we are able to talk about what happens to people and to help them. Because if I'm honest with myself, throwing myself into work and making sure that Walthamstow came first was a way of not dealing with how I was feeling about what was happening to me.
I might be making a judgment here, but there are going to be constituencies around the country where the volume of work is just not as much as a really busy inner city constituency like yours in Walthamstow. And do you think that, you know, perhaps it's been the case that some other MPs have just been able to take some time off without having to need cover?
Well, when I've talked to MPs in the kind of seats you're talking about, what they've said is that they basically pretended that they were in Westminster rather than in their constituencies in order to hide and be able to spend some time with their newborn child and just hoped that the work didn't pile up too much. That's not a satisfactory way of dealing. Or they've asked colleagues to do casework, which, you know, breaches all the parliamentary protocols. I also think there's just something quite important here about the taxpayer. Like, you should expect your MP to be doing something else other than just voting. So you should expect when your MP is absent, say if they became ill and they need to take some time out for being ill, that there would be cover to make sure that you weren't missing out. I think we have to flip the question round and say, of course MPs do things and therefore that must be covered. And if they're not doing things, that should be a question that we should be asking, whether they're pregnant or not. I think the reality of this is, you know, this is the first job I've ever done where there isn't a job description. People don't necessarily know all the things that MPs do, but they still have lots of expectations about what MPs could do. You know, I've had people come to me in the last 6 months from things about immigration and welfare and housing to international policies to, can I get the timetable for an airline company to change so they can get a cheaper flight and save some money on their hotel bills for their holiday? Now, I'm not necessarily suggesting that's a good thing, but it does reflect people's presumption, rightly, that their MP doesn't just represent them in Parliament, but is also part and parcel of their community. if we value that and we value the work that MPs do linking people up to the political decision-making process, then we should value it enough to make sure it can continually be done, not be dependent on whether or not a person can sacrifice their family or sacrifice their health. Because frankly, then the only people you're going to get who are going to want to do this job are either the kind of people who have independently wealth and can pay for their own wet nurses, perhaps, I don't know whether that's where Ipsa we're going with this, or people of a certain age. And what I think comes back from talking to my colleagues about it is Ipsa and the parliamentary authorities hadn't dealt with this because we'd only had people of a certain age and a certain generation and a certain background before. We hadn't had people coming through like myself going, well, I would like to spend some time with a newborn child. If I'm lucky enough to make this pregnancy work, I do want to spend some time with this child. I feel like I've fought quite hard to have a baby, and therefore it would be good at least. I mean, maybe I'll get bored, I don't know. but I would like to be able to be with a newborn child. And I think most people in the country would recognise that and respect that and not say, as some have said on Twitter, well, that's it, you should resign, or, well, that's it, we shouldn't employ people to be MPs of an age where this might be an issue. They'd say, if we want our parliament to reflect our country, we need to sort this out.
You mentioned that having to work through miscarriages, and clearly that's something that is a major issue for so many people at work, where they might feel unable to talk to their bosses about that and have to schedule it around work in order not to necessarily reveal they're trying for a family. Is it something that you know, beyond this, and hopefully if you win this battle with Ipsa, that you'd like to keep campaigning on?
I think we have so far to go to make Britain a place where fertility isn't a point at which women are discriminated against, whether you choose to reproduce or you don't choose to reproduce. There's just such an ingrained presumption that women having children is a problem they have to manage rather than something society has to get right to help make happen, that we allow a level of inequality to be baked in from the start. And my experience with Ipsa is just one small sliver of that. You know, 30% of women who go on maternity leave get into debt. That can't be right. But it's a reflection of the fact that actually, although we might have laws around provision of maternity leave, in terms of actual maternity pay and making it work for families, let alone for the dads involved, we've a long way to go. Miscarriage is one of those things where, partly because people say, oh, it happens so commonly, as though that makes it okay. That was the thing I found really hard to deal with, was people kind of going, oh, well, never mind. And you were like, well, it minds quite a lot to me, because, like anybody, I think, who's experienced a miscarriage, I of course blamed myself. I was obsessed with things I might have done or might have missed out on. And, you know, you get caught up in your own head about it. So absolutely. And of course, you know, the idea that other people have a view on that and feel that that's information they can share and feel that they have a right to judge you is a thing that compounds when you're incredibly vulnerable. I've had some extraordinary emails over the last couple of days from people about their own experiences that would just make you weep. We've got a long way to go to not make it something that you should feel ashamed about, which is certainly how I felt at points, because I felt I was deficient in some way. One way it possibly did positively affect my work is that anybody who was a political detractor of mine, you know, whether on the left or the right, I thought, there's nothing you guys can say to me that will ever get to me in the way that I feel about myself right now, because I've lost another baby.
Stella Creasy there talking to Jessica. Anishka's quite brave, isn't it, to be so frank about Stella's personal situation in that way?
Incredibly brave. When you read her article in The Guardian and you hear what she's been through, you can't help but feel for her, and also feel for the fact that she felt she had to put that out there because of the situation she'd been forced into. I mean, ever since I started working in the lobby in 2009, I have been struck by the way that it is in the dark ages when it comes to people having families, not just women, but men too. I mean, the idea that it's taken this long to get to proxy voting. I mean, we've had people like Harriet Harman and Yvette Cooper have cabinet level jobs whilst having young children, and they have just struggled on, and it's about time they change things. And I just think, you know, strength to Stella for saying this, and it just shines a light on Ipsa and it makes them look absolutely terrible.
In fairness to Ipsa, I think what's happened is the employment status of MPs is very unclear. So they're neither employees of the House of Commons, nor are they self-employed. They're defined, I think, for tax purposes as office holders. And as such, the rights that you would normally get either as an employee or self-employed don't apply to an MP. So that's what's happened. And therefore there's a hole. And I think that's, you know, needs reforming. So I definitely sympathise with
I understand Stella, the technical thing, but what you just have to get to is that these are the people who represent the country. These are the people who make the laws to protect other people around the country. They have to set an example.
I agree. And there should be a change. And what seems to be the problem is that when mum or dad, who is an MP, wants to take time off with their child, you know, there isn't a kind of replacement there. And that sort of cover, which what Stella is pushing for, isn't there.
And does exist in other countries, which I didn't even know about until I read her piece.
Yeah, I mean, if you were a CEO of a large company and you needed to go on paternity or maternity leave, then, you know, there would be somebody in replacement. So it makes sense that that should happen for MPs as well, definitely.
Okay, we'll have to leave that there.
Our future doesn't need to be Brexit. We could change the future. We could put Britain back at the heart of Europe again. We could be proud of leading the fight for a fairer and stronger future together.
Now, after Labour's drubbing in the European elections last month, when it picked up just 14% of the vote, many expected Jeremy Corbyn might take the hint and come out fighting against Brexit. That's certainly what his deputy Tom Watson wants. But not so fast. Though some shadow cabinet ministers previously opposed to a referendum have had a change of heart, Corbyn himself is holding the line against full-throated support for Remain. And a fractious shadow cabinet meeting yesterday ended with a promise to come back to the issue next week. I spoke to Labour's Clive Lewis, one of those MPs trying to put pressure on Corbyn to come off the Brexit fence.
I think we've made the argument. I think we've won the argument, to be quite frank, about the need for a second referendum, a PV, a people's vote. But clearly, that memo hasn't quite reached the very top yet. We'll see in the next couple of days whether that shift does happen. Mm. I know that there is, you know, pressure on Jeremy and others in his office to make that shift. It feels like the rest of the party has already moved on. You can see that from many of the outriders on social media who have been defending the line now beginning to shift. And I think, you know, in my own CLP, you can see, I saw, you know, a couple of months ago that people who were doggedly sticking to that position of the middle ground, of the soft Brexit, just saw the writing on the wall. And then I think for most people, you know, the European elections showed just how badly our position had kind of mutated into, from being a position which I think a lot of people thought was the right place to be, trying to find a compromise. Mm. But the ground has shifted. It's polarised. Opinion is polarised. I can see that in my own constituency. And we then did the kind of rather amazing job of alienating both Leave and Remain in that European election. And that's disastrous for a political party in any election.
But what do you say to those people who would say there are lots of Labour voters in Leave seats who voted Leave and who would feel quite betrayed, often traditional Labour voters, who'd feel quite betrayed by you initially saying, we'll respect the result of the referendum, and now saying something different?
I think, look, when the facts change, you change your mind, and the facts have changed. I think where the Labour Party tried to navigate this, it tried to find a compromise, but those negotiations failed. Because they failed, and because we're now on the brink of potentially seeing a Conservative Prime Minister who will possibly ensure, if he thinks it's necessary in his own opinion, a no-deal Brexit. I think that kind of turns this into a binary choice now. Either you're going to accept that or you're going to fight against it. And the best way to fight against it is to give this back to the British public. I think increasingly what's, you know, people can see that, you know, if we're going to count down to October and potential for no deal, then, you know, the alternative is no deal or revoke. That's where it can be potentially moving to. And I don't want that, because I think revoke is not a place I would want to go. Because
and that,
I think
that would be revoking Article 50. So that would be just be stopping Brexit altogether without a referendum.
Because that would be, you know, if you get down to the timescales and the European Union says, you know what, we've had enough now, then those in Parliament that didn't want no deal, the only alternative would be that. And I don't want to get to that point. So, you know, PV is about more democracy, not less democracy. And it's about people being able to reassess the situation after 2 years, after a deal that Theresa May negotiated on the table that Parliament hasn't been able to pass. But that is the only game in town. The European Union tells us that. And to put that to the British people, or to put something to the British people, but to give them the option to remain.
And what are the risks for Labour, do you think, of not
sort of planting its flag of not getting this right now?
I think that we saw in the European elections what the risk is. And I think what you would see is we would probably be the second biggest party if we came second, but we may not be able to form a government on our own. And I think, you know, that's a problem. And if we come second, there's a real chance that you'd have a kind of Brexit party stroke, hard right Tory party in government. And I think that terrifies a lot of people. If we don't grip that now, then I think increasingly many people will say, I don't know whether I can bring myself to vote for a party where I don't know where you stand on this critical issue. They're not going to listen to anything else. We know that. We know people struggle on the doorstep. We struggle to get a hearing on all the other fantastic policies that we have or could have because people are saying, you know, this is the biggest issue for me at the moment and we've got to change.
And it's Jeremy Corbyn ultimately who needs to make that decision, who needs to own it, is it?
Yeah, and, you know, look, lots of people, you know, blame the people around Jeremy and Seamus and Kerry and Len, the four M's, whatever you want to call it. And I can understand why people might be frustrated, whether it's true or not, that they're having a disproportionate influence on him. But ultimately, Jeremy's the leader. And Jeremy's the only one, really, that's accountable to us. So I kind of think, yes, he does need to change his position on this. And it needs to happen sooner rather than later.
Anoushka, I feel as if I've written the story, Jeremy
like
Corbyn, inches towards a referendum at least 100 times over the last 6 months. Are the tectonic plates finally moving, do you think?
Well, I think Labour is going to be forced to move in a position, particularly if we are heading so fast towards a general election. I mean, the thing that really makes me feel for Labour is that this is a lose-lose situation. I mean, even that polling that was done by the TSSA union that was about showing how if you don't go to a more pro-Remain position, you're going to be really, really hurt, showed that if you go towards a more pro-Remain position, you're going to be hurt too, but just not quite as bad. And I was talking to one Labour MP this week who hadn't signed that letter, but, you know, represents a northern working class community. And they were saying, you know, you put these stats up and you show how, for example, overall, we have a kind of big majority of Remain supporters who voted for Labour in 2017. But then you knock on doors in our communities, the communities we represent, and you meet the people who once voted for us, who backed Brexit, who are angry. And you feel we also have to represent those people. And it would be this huge betrayal to move away from our promise on Brexit. And so it is an incredibly thorny and difficult situation to be in. And, you know, Tom Watson is doing what he ought to do as deputy leader. He's trying to represent members. The difficulty for Jeremy Corbyn is he's always said it's about members. And on this issue, the members feel very passionately in a slightly different direction.
And is it too late? I mean, we saw the Liberal Democrats have kind of made themselves the standard bearer, haven't they, for an anti-Brexit position. They did very well in the European elections. Is it almost too late for Labour? If I'm an incredibly frustrated Remain voter, will I be tempted, do you think, to put my vote with the Lib Dems at that general election, even if Labour now shifts its position?
I don't think Jeremy Corbyn wants to be the Prime Minister of young metropolitan Remain voters, apart from anything else. I think, you know, he wants to be the Prime Minister for traditional Labour voters as well. So there's a strong reluctance. My suspicion at the moment is they'll tiptoe towards a position of saying we should have a general election. If we're elected, we'll try and renegotiate. If we don't manage to renegotiate, we'll have a referendum on Brexit. I don't think they're going to go full on Remain in the sort of Liberal Democrat mould.
And apparently he said at yesterday's Shadow Cabinet Minister meeting that he'd been reading Harold Wilson's autobiography, remembering the 70s referendum. What would that tell him?
Well, it would tell him that maybe he could orchestrate a policy of supporting a referendum and then give his cabinet sort of freedom to go and campaign as they wished and slightly step back from the fray.
That went well for David Cameron.
Well, the other thing I would say is, you know, for all that, remember all that fighting there was in 2016 about did Jeremy Corbyn try and did he try very hard? Well, we saw him in 2017 now, so we've got something to compare it against if we do that again. And so he's in a really difficult situation because we know what Jeremy Corbyn full-throated looks like now. And if he's anything less in a referendum, it's going to cause him problems.
Yeah, although he's at his best when he's got his heart in something.
Absolutely.
Isn't he? And the feeling about those 2016 performances in the referendum was that it just wasn't something he felt particularly passionate about.
Yeah, I mean,
about.
He's a slightly strange politician, isn't he? Is that he obviously doesn't like saying things he doesn't think.
And he is passionately against the European Union and has been for many, many years. I mean, he may have shifted in that position now and he may be passionately against no deal, but it's all out there on tape, you know, how he campaigned in Ireland, you know, at the time of the Lisbon Treaty, for example. We know what Jeremy Corbyn thinks about the EU. And as you say, Heather, he's the man who will speak with his heart and finds it very difficult not to.
I suppose the paradox is it's hard to see how Jeremy Corbyn becomes Prime Minister without relying on a coalition that will insist on a referendum.
Especially if he is now against Boris Johnson. When you were talking, Ryan, earlier about the idea of Boris Johnson saying, look, it's us, deal or no deal. Well, if Labour does anything other than move to a Remain position in that situation, its vote's going to be split with the Lib Dems. And that is a real problem, especially for people who want to vote tactically to stop no deal, for example.
But Ryan, the Conservatives would be quite pleased, wouldn't they, if Labour moved neatly into a Remain position and then there's a very clear dividing line and perhaps Boris Johnson could pick up those Brexit Party votes and it makes it a sort of simple, clear battle.
Yeah, I think it will. And I don't think Jeremy Corbyn has a choice. He might be very reluctant to do so. But I think faced with a scenario which is like a second referendum where Tories are saying we're leaving, then, you know, Labour have got to kind of reject that. The constructive ambiguity won't work. They'll be flattened and their vote will split. And, you know, you might be surprised to hear me say this, but I'm kind of sympathetic to what Jeremy Corbyn's tried to achieve and to some degree Theresa May. It's an incredibly fractious, divisive issue. They've tried to resolve it. You know, Theresa May perhaps went too hard to begin with in 2017 with her Lancaster House speech, and she's had to roll back from that. But in the end, a compromise was tried to be reached. But unfortunately, the politics got in the way and people tried to make political capital out of it. And what I would say, I mean, I'm a Remainer, but to a lot of Remainers who have blocked that deal under Theresa May, I think, you know, we are now heading to a situation where through an election, I think it's more likely that we will get a no-deal Brexit rather than Remain. Because this idea, even with even if you had a second referendum, for example, which would probably be a no-deal versus no-Brexit scenario, it would almost just be like a rerun of the 2016 referendum. Loads of people would be saying, oh, no-deal will cause huge economic catastrophe. And all the Leave voters will say, well, you said that in 2016, and here we are with record levels of employment and the economy still growing. They wouldn't believe it. So my point is that all these people who have blocked Theresa May's deal and waited because they feel a referendum is the way to keep us in the EU, I feel that they will face the consequences now, because I think it's very likely that we're heading for a no deal, which will be incredibly disruptive, as Anand has talked about, and an incredible disappointment. But because people have been unable to compromise, that is the situation we are now facing, where it's basically a very divisive showdown type election.
And meanwhile, and the sort of the absolute state of politics is pretty grim, isn't it? I mean, trust out there is rock bottom in what MPs at Westminster are doing, yeah, have done, and not surprisingly.
There's been some staggering and really quite depressing polling about faith in the political system, faith in parties. I mean, we're a very, very divided nation, but the one thing we seem to agree on is that politicians have let us down. So, Heather, you face the prospect now not only of a general election, but a general election and then a referendum, so you can't have another holiday ever.
I think on that very cheering note, we better bring things to a close. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Anushka Astana, Ryan Shorthouse, Anand Menon, Clive Lewis and Stella Creasy. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.